Welcome to The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. On today's show, is it time? Time to ban bicycles from Seattle sidewalks? Is it time to ban smokeless tobacco from Safeco Field? Is it time to change life for pro sports cheerleaders? You see this when you go to a Seahawks game. The men are on the field in combat. The women, the Sea Gals, are cheering on the men. They're conventionally pretty, but not too sexy. That's unwholesome. It sure isn't gender neutral, none of it. But is the disparate treatment in the workplace of cheerleaders illegal? A former New Orleans Saints cheerleader has filed a complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. New York Times reporter Ken Belson wrote about it this week. Welcome, Ken.
Thanks for having me on, Bill.
What is this former cheerleader alleging?
She's basically saying there's a double standard in the rules that govern her life as a cheerleader and those of the players. This extends from the way she's allowed or not allowed to use her social media accounts, the way she's treated in the stadium, and something that's at the core of cheerleaders' handbooks throughout the league is the so-called anti-fraternization policy that prohibits cheerleaders from even interacting with players in anything more than a kind of casual hello.
Yes, and you write about how unequal that anti-fraternization policy is between cheerleaders and players.
Yes, that's right. So in her case, she, as she noted, and other teams have similar policies, if she's in a restaurant and a player arrives in the restaurant after her, she's obligated to leave the restaurant. And conversely, if she arrives at a restaurant and a player's already there, she has to leave and not have dinner in that restaurant. That's just an extreme example, but it's one of many. And it puts the onus, in all these cases, puts the onus on the woman, the cheerleader, for policing this activity. There's no penalties for the players for reaching out to a cheerleader, but if a cheerleader reaches out to a player, it's a firing offense.
Cheerleaders often have to police their own social media, so they're actively blocking players. They have to go around and do that. The players don't have rules about who they can follow on social media. Cheerleaders pay for their own makeup a lot of the time, uniforms. They have to sell calendars in bikinis. It goes on and on.
Yeah, it's I mean, look, the players are the ones who play on the field. They get paid big salaries. But these rules against the cheerleaders or imposed on the cheerleaders are all for, in many cases, less than minimum wage. They are paid almost nothing. Often they are entirely as contractors, no benefits. And yet this is also restricting their commerce. It's an extension of the social media policy. Bailey Davis, the woman I wrote about, wanted to get a job as a summer camp dance teacher and couldn't because she's not allowed to promote that she works for the Saints. And she's only allowed to use her first name in public. So she can't get a second job. It's not like she's paid so much money that they don't want her to work a second job. It's simply that they want to control how she uses the Saints while promoting herself, which is to say only in the most team-approved ways. And that's a restriction of commerce as well.
But how could cheerleaders be paid less than minimum wage?
Well, if you add up the number of hours they're obligated to work, each team is slightly different. She get in Bailey's case, she was getting the minimum wage her first year, which in Louisiana was $7.25, and she was getting paid or reimbursed for part of her travel, but it was a two-hour commute each way. But the women have to show up 4 hours before kickoff, then work the entire game, and then afterwards as well, greeting fans as they leave or saying goodbye to fans as they leave stadiums, and all sorts of other appearances. So if you add up the number of hours, it actually is less than a minimum wage, although they'll claim that they are paid minimum wage. So you're not talking about a lot. Then, of course, they're paying for their own transportation, their own nails, tanning salons, hairstylists, clothing. I can't believe that anybody would do this expecting to make a lot of money.
Well, why do football teams say they legitimately treat players and cheerleaders differently in these many ways?
The argument is that this is done for the cheerleaders' protection, which sounds a bit patronizing. You could imagine a scenario where a woman, a cheerleader, has her full name on a website or in a calendar or some other place, and people are stalking her. So that's the argument. If we only let you use your first name, if you don't if you're not allowed to post pictures of yourself in Saints uniforms on your site, you have to make your Instagram site private, for instance. That's for your protection. Meanwhile, the players are allowed to promote themselves wearing team gear and NFL gear, are allowed to do so without their shirts on, holding bottles of alcohol, doing all sorts of things that the cheerleaders are forbidden from doing, and nobody says the players are being stalked. Now, obviously, it's a different scenario with men versus women, but this is all done under the guise of protecting the women, except that the rules force the women to do a lot of the protecting of themselves.
Well, would a team be held responsible if a cheerleader were stalked and the team didn't prevent it?
I think they would point to their rules to say, see, we had these rules in place. But the cheerleaders, like Bailey, told me she routinely gets emails and Facebook messages from fans, and she just deletes them. So they already have finding her anyway, even despite all these rules.
What would this former cheerleader who's filed this EEOC complaint, what would she have to show to win her case?
She would have to show that the discrimination is against one gender, which in this case it is, in the sense that all the cheerleaders are women and all the players are men, and that there clearly are two sets of rules. There is a double standard. Now, there are all sorts of exemptions to this that I'm sure a good employment lawyer defending the team will point out. Restaurants that, like Hooters, for instance, where women are hired for very specific roles, they may argue that. But these are sort of workplace rules. These are not necessarily roles about their appearance. These are roles about how their lives are controlled outside of work, for instance, in the case of their social media accounts.
Could teams argue that this is not about gender, but about, well, like an office hierarchy, like any office where a subordinate employee keeps calendar appointments and orders office supplies, and it's the players who bring in the money and they're harder to replace. And yeah, we value them higher, and you see that in the workplace. And we happen to have this obvious and so coded and stereotypical gender separation at the same time.
They will probably argue that players, I mean, to be clear, in the NFL's case, the players have a collective bargaining agreement. They're part of a union. They are treated differently. Even if we say that the team accountant is just as important as a starting quarterback, which obviously is a very different calculation, the point is they have their own labor agreement. And so conditions are different. But this is governing off-field, out-of-stadium behavior. We're not talking about a cheerleader who wants to wear red lipstick and is forced to wear green lipstick. We're talking about dipping into her private life and controlling how she can live when she's off duty or outside of the stadium. For instance, going to a restaurant or a bar, what she can do with her private life and can't do with her private life. And I think that's the crux of their argument, is this isn't about game day. This is about everything else.
We're talking with New York Times reporter Ken Belson, who's written about the cheerleader system in general, in particular the case of this former New Orleans Saints cheerleader filing a complaint. Is it clearly legal, and do we assume it will stay legal for a company to require job applicants to be conventionally attractive women, as goes on in, you know, NFL teams?
I think that is allowed, in the sense that if you're producing a product, the Rockettes here at Radio City Music Hall in New York, actors and actresses, dancers in all sorts of shows, for instance, the way you look is a big part of the job description. So I think that will continue. EEOC cases, you know, discrimination cases, are actually quite hard to prove, and it will be an uphill battle for Bailey. One possible way around it is to start hiring men as cheerleaders too.
Right.
That's one way. And the Los Angeles Rams have just hired two men to be dancers on their team. So that's one potential solution. The other is just simply to lift some of these rules. The ban on social media, using last names, things like that. This whole instance of fraternization, which again forces the woman to change her behavior, but not the man. That part is thing. Those are rules that could be changed without costing anybody a penny.
Well, here I'm asking you to, if you want to give an opinion or a forecast. But I wonder, even if the cheerleader system is legal or is nipped and tucked to be more legal. Do you, in your reporting, do you get any sense that we're seeing a cultural shift away from the way we've thought about cheerleaders?
When you say the way we think, you're talking about
society, socially. You know, there's a difference between what's legal and what is what we expect of a company, what maybe what the ticket buying public and the TV watching public will put up with.
That's a good question. There are several indicators. One was in Buffalo a couple of years ago, where the team, the team's cheerleaders, the Buffalo Jills, which was run by a company. The Jills, yes. Yeah. Well, you've got the Seagulls.
Yes.
So, we can have a separate show on the naming of these cheerleader groups. But in any event, they were sued for back wages because the cheerleaders alleged they were underpaid for many years. And rather than litigate it, the team just simply got rid of the cheerleaders. So, you know, rather than bother with the dollar figure and the court time and everything else, they just said, you know what, it's not worth it. That, to me, is an indication that the cheerleaders could go away, that the NFL and the teams could just decide it's just not worth the trouble, which is another way of answering your question. They may not care enough. They're not that integral to the putting on the production of an NFL game. Frankly, if you're at the stadium in Seattle and you're watching it, you can barely see the cheerleaders from most seats. They're tiny. So they're really for television, and they're kind of just part of the trapping of a game. And some owners just might say, you know what, it's just not worth it. We don't need it. It's not essential to the running of the game. I think where cheerleaders are probably most valuable to the team is not on game day, at events, charity functions, that kind of thing, where it promotes the team's brand in places where, let's say, a player wouldn't necessarily go. Meeting the troops, they go overseas, for instance. So they're kind of ambassadors, and from that perspective, they're good, but they're not essential to the functioning of a team. And in that way, teams just may say it's not worth the trouble.
Right, and as some teams do away with cheerleaders, and the LA Rams have male cheerleaders, it just starts to more and more highlight how the Seattle Seahawks are making an active choice by having Seagulls. You know, it's not because everybody does it, not because they have to.
Yes, and so if there's a if one or two or three men make the squad, I wonder what they'll have to do with the name. But look, I mean, I don't want to be judgmental about cheerleaders, and frankly, even the cheerleaders who I've spoken to who complained about these rules said they loved being cheerleaders. They just felt like they were in a boot camp and they were not treated equitably. And so from that perspective, I think they'd like the changes to it. And there are many places in America, and I've been, you know, to Texas, to Florida, where cheerleading is still very popular with girls and teenagers and then into college. So it's still seen as something you'd that many women aspire to do. I just think when they get there, they're often up for a rude awakening.
New York Times reporter Ken Bellison, thanks for your reporting on this and for talking to us on KUOW.
My pleasure. Thanks.
So what about the Seagulls? What is that cheerleader job like? KUOW newscaster Paige Browning is in the studio with us now. Hiya, Paige.
Hey, Bill.
Do the Seagulls have to follow the same rules that we're hearing about in other cities?
Well, just flipping through the Seagulls rules, actually a lot is up for interpretation. It's not very clear. And I should also say that I'm going off the Seagulls rules from 2015. They wouldn't give us their most recent. But something like that Ken Bellison was talking about, the fraternizing with players, that's in the Seagulls rules. The rules say members of the squad cannot date, live with, or fraternize with Seahawks players or any Seahawks employee. So as Ken was talking about, we've heard in some cities, if a cheerleader goes into a bar or restaurant and there's a football player there, they have to leave. That's not explicitly written in the Seagulls rules, but maybe the coaches could interpret it that way. We also saw that, just like Ken said, yep, Seagulls have to show up 4 hours before kickoff, do activities after the game, They don't have to pay for their uniforms, which some cheerleading squads do, but they do have to keep them clean, quote, at all times. And one other thing that Ken mentioned with the names, the Seagulls do go by their first names on social media, and it's pretty hard to find what their full name is or what their full-time job is outside of the Seagulls. They're just branded, you know, Seagull Kendra, basically.
And we talked in that last interview with the New York Times reporter about some cheerleaders, in effect, receiving less than minimum wage. What do we know about that in Seattle?
From what I can tell, the Seagulls might have one of the better pay contracts among NFL cheerleaders. They are paid minimum wage for every hour they work, and they're also eligible for overtime pay. And they can work outside events like commercial appearances that are put on by the Seahawks. They get paid for those. They also get a couple of guest tickets for games that they perform at. So if I'm just doing some quick math, Washington's minimum wage is $11.50 an hour. So they're getting paid about $90 for a full game day. I'm not using Seattle's minimum wage because Seahawks list their headquarters as in Renton.
It's in Renton, right. Yeah. Okay, KOW's Paige Browning, anything else you found in the Seagulls rulebook as you read it?
Yeah, I guess I'll note a couple of other things. Some things were expected. You can't go out in public just wearing your Seagulls uniform wherever you want. The team owns the uniform. I get that. Cheerleaders also must maintain their weight, skin condition, and muscle tone. Otherwise, you could be sent home from a game or fired if you have a change in any of those things, including weight. Mm-hmm. They don't specify exactly what weight they need to maintain, however. The director can also set policies on eating, drinking, smoking, and other activities. One of those activities mentioned is gum chewing.
Gum chewing, not allowed.
Not allowed.
Okay. KUOW's Paige Browning in from our newsroom to tell you about this. Thanks a lot, Paige.
Thanks, Bill.
So we've been talking about this EEOC complaint from a former New Orleans Saints cheerleader. We've been talking about the Seattle Seagulls. I'd like to talk to you, Seagulls, former Seagulls. We'd love to hear from you if you're listening. Get in touch with us and let us know what life is or was like as a Seagull. We are at record@kuow.org, record@kuow.org. And we'll continue in a moment. The King County Board of Health is set to vote today on whether or not to ban smokeless tobacco in sports stadiums. That would mean no more chewing tobacco for Mariners players or their fans at Safeco Field. In support of this measure is Annie Tegan with the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids in Seattle. Welcome, Annie.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Here is a former Major League Baseball player. His name is C.J. Nitkowski, telling a program called Illinois Rising about the difference between beer and tobacco in a sports stadium.
Can't get cancer if I'm sitting next to a guy who's using smokeless tobacco. There's never a fight in the stands because people are having too much smokeless tobacco, right? But there is when they're drinking too much beer.
So, as he suggests, I can't get cancer from secondhand chewing tobacco. Why ban it, Annie?
Well, you know, we've been leading the effort nationwide to, it's called the Knock Tobacco Out of the Park campaign, and we're really excited about it. You know, the action won't affect players and what they can do in their personal life, although they should be encouraged to quit using tobacco for their own health, of course. The truth is that baseball stadiums are workplaces and public places, and so it's entirely appropriate to restrict the use of tobacco in those settings.
I understand the workplace secondhand smoke argument, but what is the smokeless tobacco in a workplace argument?
Well, you know, while players are on the job, like any of us, they're on the field and they're in front of a camera, and they have the responsibility to set the right example for kids. We certainly don't, you know, tobacco industry, smokeless tobacco companies spent more than $500 million on marketing, you know, in 2013, the most recent year we have that information available. And we don't need to make it any easier for the tobacco industry to get free airtime. You know, these kids really look up to these players. They watch what they do. They watch what they eat, and they watch if they use tobacco. So we want to make sure that they're setting the right role for being good role models for kids. You know, I think the bottom line is that, you know, yes, kids really do look up to these players. And what we've seen in the past, if in the past 40 years or so. I mean, chewing tobacco has just been linked to baseball in such a way that it makes folks think that if they want to play baseball, if they want to be like the big league players, they need to chew. One interesting note that, over the past 15 years, we've made dramatic progress in reducing smoking rates among our kids, cutting cigarette use among high school boys by more than half, for example. But during that same period, we've not seen the same progress in reducing the use of smokeless tobacco, especially among those who participate in organized sports. So, for example, male high school athletes, smokeless tobacco is at an alarming rate of 17.4%, and that's higher than non-athletes.
Do you know your Seattle Mariners stats when it comes to how many players use smokeless tobacco?
Well, I know there are a few of them that do use smokeless tobacco. I do know that the Mariners themselves, the team management is supportive of this. And, we're really excited about this because we're really seeing a shift. And Seattle, if King County passes this rule today, the Seattle Mariners will be the 15th Major League Baseball team to have such a policy in place in their stadium. So we're excited. That'll mean we're halfway there.
You said the Mariners management supports you on this. So why don't and we've said that Safeco fans already can't use chewing tobacco, so why isn't this up to the Mariners to ban their players from using it?
That's a great question. It's because of the collective bargaining agreement that that they have, the MLB Players Union has. And so right now, any new major league player that signs on or is traded, they have to follow the new revised agreement, which means no using smokeless tobacco while you're playing. But the other players have been grandfathered in, so we're just kind of speeding up the process.
How would this be enforced? Random searches in the clubhouse?
No, not at all. I mean, I think I don't think we've had any problems in the other 14 places where it's been implemented, and we certainly don't expect to see any problems here. I think the Mariners players themselves, certainly they may even want to quit themselves, and I encourage them to do so by calling 1-800-QUIT-NOW. But we really think that we don't see that there will be a problem. They'll get a warning if anything later on they would get a fine, but we don't expect to have any problems.
Well, if we're talking about wanting players to be role models for kids, we could be talking about beer. What about, could you imagine the county just banning alcohol in a stadium?
Well, the difference between, I think, alcohol and smokeless tobacco, tobacco is designed, when used as directed, it will kill you, and it causes cancer. And we know the detrimental effects that smokeless tobacco has on the current ball players, as well as just the general public. So it's devastating. And like I said before, Big Tobacco spends millions to market these products to addict new customers. And so we just want to do our part to make sure that we're not helping them do that in any way.
Okay. Go ahead.
Our youth advocates are really excited to testify in the next couple hours at the King County Board of Health meeting. So we're excited to hear what they have to say.
That's what I was going to say. The vote is happening today at the King County Board of Health. And so the vote would be on whether to ban smokeless tobacco, the chew, the dip in sports stadiums, three different stadiums in the county?
Yeah, we have. It's already not allowed really at the other stadium. So this would be just a change really for Safeco.
Okay, a change for Safeco. And it's already illegal for fans to chew and dip, but we'd be talking about making that go for the players that kids are watching on TV. And we've been talking about this with Annie Tagan with the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. She's based in Seattle. Annie, thanks for this.
Thank you.
She's advocacy director of the campaign, and she'll be at the meeting this afternoon where they're set to take this vote. You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke, and we did ask the Major League Baseball Players Union for their take, because as you just heard, they're the ones who currently are apparently allowing players to use smokeless tobacco because the Mariners management say they're on board. We haven't heard back yet from Major League Baseball Players Union. We're going to continue our show in just a minute. This week on The Record, we've been talking about the new juvenile justice facility going up in Seattle's Central District. You heard from the King County executive, Dow Constantine, supporting this facility. You heard from former mayoral candidate, attorney activist Nikita Oliver, who's part of the No New Youth Jail Coalition. We've got KOW reporter Patricia Murphy following this story to tie things up for you. Welcome, Patricia.
Thanks, Bill.
First of all, why did voters say yes to building a new juvenile justice center right next to the old one in Seattle?
The county decided that the facility is not usable in the condition that it is. It is decrepit. There is brown water coming out. There is peeling paint. It is no longer conducive to rehabilitation, which is what the county ultimately says it wants to do in that place. You have to remember that the kids that come in there, they are freshly arrested. This is an opportunity for an intervention, according to the county. So this facility is no longer conducive to that intervention because it is no longer usable for that purpose. It's ugly. It's not a pleasant place to be. No detention facility is a pleasant place to be. The county thinks it can do better.
A really interesting piece of this is that the county itself has said one of its goals is zero youth detention. That's a goal. Why would the county build a new facility if the goal is for it to be empty?
Very true. In 2017, Dow Constantine, our county executive, called for a goal of zero youth detention. The county council adopted that goal. The path to zero youth detention, according to Dow, is that we need this new facility to move towards this goal, to create a space that is conducive to rehabilitation, to family interventions, in order to create a non-secure space for people to interact with the court system in a meaningful way.
What is so more conducive to rehabilitation about this new facility that's being built?
So here's one example that I can think of. There is a space in the jail right now that used to house kids. Now they use that space for poetry. They have a group pogo that comes in, right? And they do poetry in that space. That's one way they have reused that space. In the other part of the jail, they do a family integrated transition program for kids who have abused their parents or in an intervention program. That has now become a non-secure space. They have done what they could to try to turn this very secure space into a better facility. There is no...
So it's less of a lockup.
It's less of a lockup in some areas, but it is still a detention center. And there are people like Dow Constantine, our county executive, who think that we could do a much better job by kids by reinvigorating this space and redesigning this space to help families feel more able to participate in a meaningful way.
One of the problems we heard this week from Nikita Oliver, the one of the No New Youth Jail activists, is that the location, the Central District Seattle location of this new center, that's a problem. What's the problem?
The problem with that is if we are truly moving towards a zero youth detention, if we are in fact, which is true, incarcerating fewer kids in the detention center, then we need to bring those programs closer to the people where our referrals are coming from. Federal Way, Auburn, those South King County cities. I hear from parents quite frequently that their interaction with the justice system, even if they are in diversion programs that take place south of the city, are very difficult to participate in. You have to remember that the families that are participating in diversion are families that are dealing with issues well beyond this situation with their kid. So when Nikita Oliver says location is a problem, what she means is the closer we can bring those programs to the communities where the referrals are coming from, the better outcomes we are going to have.
And why does the county say it wants to have all this stuff in Seattle proper?
Well, I think some of it is that it has always been here. This is the centrally located place where a lot of services take place. And as much as the county is trying to branch out, the reality is there are an awful lot of interactions with the justice system that need to take place in Seattle. Some people see this as an opportunity to break this facility up into annexes and scatter it throughout the county to make it easier on families.
Something that came up with both Nikita Oliver and County Executive Constantine was the racial disparity among kids who are incarcerated. Do either of them have any solutions for that?
I think Nikita Oliver and Dow Constantine both see solutions in the community. I think that what the slowdown is that this is not an easy plan to implement. And a lot of it has to do with people within the system and the structures that we have in place right now being uncomfortable with the solution. It's not an easy sell on some levels. And I see an example right now of the prosecutor's office doubling down on a program. We have a restorative justice circle that the prosecutor's office has been participating in.
What's a restorative justice circle?
What it is a healing circle. You take the judge, the prosecutor, the police officers, and in some cases, the victim. It's a hard sell a lot of times for the victim. But you sit in a circle and you talk and you work on healing the trauma. Now, this is an experiment that they tried that went horribly sideways. One of these kids actually went out and murdered somebody.
After participating in the peace circle.
The right. Prosecutor's office has decided to double down and continue doing that. Continue to use these circles as a way to heal in the community. That is a difficult decision to make. That's an example of something where the county has decided that they are willing to be uncomfortable for a little bit longer to see if this is working.
Patricia, we're talking about the controversy over King County's new juvenile justice center, and yet obviously this is about something bigger, a bigger problem.
I think the county's goal of zero youth detention is really about solving the systemic racism that has infiltrated the system for so many years, about jailing so many black and brown kids. It's a laudable goal. It's a really difficult goal, one that is going to take an awful lot of work and an awful lot of uncomfortable decisions by county officials and judges.
That's KUOW's Patricia Murphy reporting. On Monday and Tuesday of this week, I interviewed the King County executive, Dow Constantine. He supports the new Juvenile Justice Center. The county voters passed a levy to pay for it. I also interviewed an opponent from the No New Youth Jail Coalition, attorney Nikita Oliver. And we'll have highlights for you from both of those interviews later today at KUOW.org. It's KUOW's The Record. We're live tweeting the show at KUOW. KUOW's Region of Boom team has been telling you about the boom time changes along a Seattle road that has many names. We are calling this series Along the Mother Road, and this week we're exploring the Alaskan Way Tunnel. The state says you could be driving the Alaskan Way Tunnel by the fall. The tunnel will replace the Alaskan Way Viaduct, which was damaged in the Nisqually earthquake. But when we asked our audience what questions they had about the tunnel, one of the most common ones was about earthquake safety. KUOW's Carolyn Adolph went to the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network at the University of Washington.
If you've ever been in an earthquake before, you remember the shaking. And if you were in a building, you remember the swaying. But what does it feel like underground?
The strength of the shaking that you feel as you start going down below the ground surface, it decreases.
This is Steve Kramer. He's an engineering professor at the University of Washington and a soil specialist. He says the tunnel becomes part of the ground and the shaking doesn't damage its structure.
Down in the ground, the tunnel doesn't have much mass at all, right? It's a bunch of concrete rings that are replacing soil that used to be there, and the soil was a lot heavier than those concrete rings. And so it just goes along for the ride with the ground as it shakes back and forth.
This is hard to picture. We spend our lives above ground, not below it. Paul Bowden manages the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network at the University of Washington. He says this is why underground is the place to be.
Underground, the wave field is weaker in the deeper parts, and if the wave field isn't distorted very much, when those waves hit the surface and there's a structure that's built on top of them, they kind of extend up the structure and it wiggles a lot. I got a question for Steve.
Engineers and seismologists don't often get to talk.
What happens when at the end of the tunnel, when it comes up to the surface? And I was wondering if those were thought of to be vulnerable spots.
Steve Kramer says yes, there is an issue at the ends of our tunnel.
Ground shaking is typically stronger at those shallow depths than it is at greater depths, and there are often weaker soils at those locations also.
At the south end of the tunnel, for example, there are softer soils from back when Seattle's waterfront was marshy and muddy.
So its reinforcement is stronger and beefier at that point, and it's accommodated by the design. So the ends of the tunnel are designed to have the same level of safety as the center part of the tunnel does. So it's a stronger tunnel where it needs to be stronger, and it's not as strong where it doesn't need to be as strong.
One deck down is the exit corridor, and then another utility.
Journalists went into the tunnel recently to see how construction is going. On the upper deck, you can still see the shape of the rings left by the tunnel borer. They say you should be in a strong place during an earthquake, and this looks stronger than under a desk or in a door frame. Paul Bowden, the seismologist, says,
for smaller earthquakes, you're certainly not going to feel anything at all different than driving. It would have to be a very serious earthquake to feel something while driving.
And that's how earthquake safe the Alaskan Way Tunnel is expected to be. In Seattle and under it, I'm Carolyn Adolph, KUOW News.
KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. The city of Seattle is waging a war on pedestrians. You thought I was going to say war on cars, right? No, a war on pedestrians, says my next guest. A new state law says electronic bikes are bikes. And in the city of Seattle, that means they can share the sidewalk with pedestrians. The former Washington State Transportation Secretary, Doug McDonald, says that is crazy. Doug, thank you for coming in.
Thank you. I walked right over from the bus stop.
Is that how you got here? Was it safely, I hope?
Yes, it was safe.
This time?
Yep.
Why do you want Seattle to keep e-bikes, electric bikes, off sidewalks?
I want to focus on an issue that I describe slightly differently. I don't even want this to be about bikes. And I certainly don't want it only to be about Lime Bike and eShare, even though those issues are really prominent now and a lot of people are talking about them and a lot of people are very unhappy about the electric bikes on sidewalks. But that's actually not the point. Today, we are on the threshold of what people call an e-mobility revolution.
It's a not immobility, e-mobility.
Absolutely. And it is a classic disruptor technology. And we have to live with that and learn that it's coming and understand what it means.
What's the e-mobility revolution?
And the e-mobility revolution is that we used to have a divide between what we called motorized transportation, that was cars, and what we called non-motorized transportation, and that was people who walked and biked. Now what we have is all kinds of innovation, which is bringing motors to the non-motorized portion of the transportation mix. So we don't just have e-bikes, although we have a lot of them, and they're very interesting because talk about that in a minute. But equally interesting are e-scooters. And in today's Washington Post, this thing is moving so quickly. Today's Washington Post has a big story about the problems with these little e-scooters, which they go 20 miles an hour, and I actually know where you can buy them in Seattle, and they're pretty nifty. You just step on them. And then there's motorized skateboards. They go 20 miles an hour. I figured this out when I was over waiting for the bus down on Bicampus Parkway there, and I watched a skateboarder go up the hill, at 18 miles an hour through some people. And I thought, wait a minute, that's a motorized skateboard. And then you got these little uni wheels and everything else.
So are you saying we need to keep e-skateboards and e-scooters and e-bikes off of sidewalks?
I think that until we figure out what we're going to do, we have to be very, very cautious about saying, well, the default on all of this is let them just go where the people walk. And I have problems with bikes on sidewalks, and I've had for a long time, and I know a lot of other people do too.
All bikes.
When they're driving through transit stops, and by the way, one of the things that I turned up in the Crosscut article that I wrote that earned me a spot on the show is if you look across the cities of the United States, we allow bikes on sidewalks in Seattle. That is absolutely not the rule in American cities. And so, for example, San Francisco, which is struggling with this e-scooter thing now, they start with the proposition that bikes themselves aren't allowed on sidewalks, and that's the same in New York and Chicago and a whole long list is the same in Palo Alto.
Okay, now you might be about to stalk out of the studio here,
right,
but I've got to tell you something. I have to admit something. I sometimes ride my bike on the sidewalk. When the sidewalk is empty or maybe one or two scattered people not walking together, if there's no bike lane, especially when I'm going uphill because it's harder to keep my bike in a perfectly straight line, and I don't want to get killed, and I don't want to block the cars that could be going much faster than I am, and I'm really careful on the sidewalk.
Let me tell you, I'll make a confession nobody's heard. I was riding the other day up Holman Road in North Seattle. It's a killer. And I rode on the sidewalk for a while.
What?
And so this is not going to be a debate about somebody who once in a while rides on the sidewalk. And by the way, everybody says, well, what about kids? Well, sure, I have kids right around. I've taken kids around my neighborhood kids, and ridden around the sidewalks. Mm. This is not what we're talking about. It is really important to say we're looking at a situation that's coming at us where a lot of people on crowded sidewalks are going to be coming at you at speed. And that's a risk conflict, and it needs to be thought through before we just piecemeal. I mean, one of the things I'm worked up about this week is a new proposal to open up the Burke Gilman Trail to e-bikes. Well, why not? There's a lot of bikes on the Burke Gilman Trail. Yeah, but how's that all fit in with the dog walkers and the pedestrians and the elderly people who are out walking a few blocks, or people in wheelchairs whom I took pictures of on Sunday when I was out there riding?
Okay.
We have a conflict growing. It's not about bikes. It's not about e-bikes. It's about what to do with speed in the places where we have protected for pedestrians.
There you go. So if the problem isn't whether it's electronic or not, you're saying the problem is how fast, whether it's whatever kind of, you could be on a tricycle. If you're going too fast, it's too fast. So could we somehow have a speed limit, allow bikes, e-bikes, whatever, on sidewalks, but if you're going past a certain amount of miles per hour, then you're ticketed?
Well, that would be one way of looking at how to work towards a solution, because a sensible solution might be if you're going walking speed, who cares how you're moving? If you're going twice walking speed, that's a bit of a problem. If you're going three times walking.
You could say that about joggers.
And joggers are a good deal less likely to be unable to avoid the person who puts down her purse and leans over, and all of a sudden, one of the crazy things about this and speed, I was thinking about this morning. One of these e-bikes weighs 45 pounds. What do you weigh?
About 180.
Okay, so you hit somebody on your e-bike going 18 miles an hour. That person just got taken out by much more mass and force than getting blindsided by an NFL safety. Mm-hmm. I mean, these aren't minor little conflicts when they hit. And I'll tell you something else that's very interesting about how to approach all this, when this goes to some of this legislation that I know you'll be talking about later. Mm. Let's say you do ride an e-bike in Seattle, one of the rental bikes. You have to be 18. That's what they think is a reasonable place to start. That's not true with the other bikes, but for the e-bikes, for Lime Bike, 18 years old.
You're saying that should be the rule. It's not now and you want it to be?
What Washington just did, thanks to Washington Bikes, whom you can talk to later, there was a regulation in Washington State, a law that said in order to ride an e-bike, you had to be 16. 16 in Washington State, 18 for a Lime e-bike for the commercial company. The law took all that away. 12 years old, 13, 14, 15, 16, 15. Welcome on an e-bike, a 20-mile-an-hour e-bike, in the state of Washington, and now we're talking about what to do on sidewalks. Now, this is not simply a question of coming on and saying, I got an answer. It's a question of saying, could we ask ourselves what is the real question? And the real question does have to do with speed. It has to do with technology. It has to do with change. These things are coming. This is not where you can say, well, you know, I'm a horse and buggy manufacturer and I don't want cars. Like much other disruptive technology, it comes, whether we want it or not. And when you go down to the scootabout store, which sells the scooters, and you look at their neat scooters, you're going to say, people are going to buy those. Mm-hmm. And yes, they will. So the question is, how are we going to fit that in so we don't just say, hey, it's the sidewalks are where everybody can go and we'll figure it out later. That, and maybe people will be courteous. What, well, some will.
Some will. To better understand the safety concerns for bikers, we have Blake Trask on the line. He's the Senior Policy Director for Cascade Bicycle Club. Welcome, Blake.
Hi, how are you?
Well, I'm good, thank you. What's your reaction to the transportation former transportation secretary talking about not just e-bikes, but e-scooters and e-skateboards, and really all bicycles being we've got a growing conflict problem here on our sidewalks.
Well, you know, Doug and I share a lot of really common interests around safety, and in fact, you know. I look back at our time working together. Doug helped Washington Bikes back in 2012, 2013, pass legislation that allowed cities like the city of Seattle to lower neighborhood streets down to 20 miles an hour, really in the efforts to promote neighborhood and bicycle, pedestrian, and school safety. So, you know, there's a lot of common interest here, and I think what we're all interested in is how do we find the best way to promote mobility and safety for all users on the road and on our sidewalks and our streets in our neighborhoods. And for us, you know, what as I'm listening to Doug talk, I really go back to there are these new technologies that are exciting. Our electric bikes are really providing people who otherwise didn't see an opportunity to be on a bicycle to get around now. And, you know, every day I'm hearing people talk about how now they can consider bicycling in Seattle. And it's really exciting, but I think a fundamental issue it goes beyond the technology is the issue that we're facing right now, which is we have a real kind of a unequal transportation system where the space is not allocated correctly, and you know there aren't enough sidewalks, and there isn't enough space for sidewalks, but there's also not enough space for bicycles. And in the downtown area alone, 25%. Of commuters come in by car, and yet 75% of the space on our city's right of way is allocated to that 25%.
So what's your solution?
Really pointing at that issue.
Yeah.
We need to provide more space for all these new and different users as Seattle changes.
How would we do that? Where would the space come from? Who loses space? What's your proposal?
Well, I think in essence, the majority in the downtown area gains the space because, as Doug has correctly pointed out, there's a lot of congestion on our sidewalks and there's not enough space. And as we look at providing safe bikeways, we need to be able to better accommodate for the majority of the users, whether they're taking their bus, going on bike share, or walking. I'm about to go to the Mariners game right now. And my route here was I took bike share, I took light rail, and now I'm walking.
Okay, so
how do we accommodate for that is, I think, the emerging challenge, and it's a really exciting one.
Okay, in one sentence, Blake, what are you saying? Fewer, take away car lanes, and we need more bike lanes and wider sidewalks? What? Give me your bullet list.
I think we need to better accommodate for the majority of the transportation public, which is people more increasingly taking transit. We need more transit lanes. We need wider sidewalks, and we need a connected bikeway network so that we can improve mobility and safety.
Okay. Doug McDonald, former transportation secretary.
Very quickly.
What's your solution?
My solution for right now is proceed with caution, which is a pretty good safety solution generally. And so right now, I wouldn't say the best thing to do is open Seattle sidewalks to e-bikes until we think through where we're going.
Keep e-bikes off the sidewalks for now.
Right now, but that's not what this is about. That's just a holding pattern until we can understand, as we do in many other areas of our lives, what we do with fundamentally disruptive technology. But I have to say to Blake, we all fought hard for 20 is plenty on Seattle streets. And now what you're saying as a result of the legislation that you just encouraged to get these 20-mile-an-hour e-bikes on sidewalks, 20 is fine on sidewalks. I don't think those two things match. And it seems to me a lot of problems have to be solved, but you have to start with not how we've got, you know, too many people in transit and too many people in cars and one thing or another. We have a safety problem of too much speed on our sidewalks, and a whole lot more of it is coming, and we should go slowly and cautiously and not do stupid, if it's harsh words, you know, interim little things to think, well, that'll be cool. Let's see how that works out. And that is where I'm coming from.
Okay, and we're coming to the end of our time. Blake, yes or no, e-bikes allowed on sidewalks in Seattle?
Fundamentally, e-bikes need to be allowed because there aren't safe places for people to bike right now in a lot of places. People don't choose to necessarily be on a sidewalk. Oftentimes, it's not safe to be on the street in those situations, and therefore they go there. I think the other thing that's just a little bit of a red herring is to say 20 miles an hour is this de facto maximum. I'd ask Doug or anybody, you know, what's your maximum car speed, and is that the speed that you go at any given point? No, you go according to the context of what is required, the speed limit, et cetera. And, you know, we do have state laws that already regulate the usage of bicycles on sidewalks in terms of how they operate around pedestrians and otherwise. So we have those opportunities, but right now, until we build more space, more space for people walking and biking, there isn't that. It's a safety issue if we just de facto ban it.
Blake Trask, Senior Policy Director, Cascade Bicycle Club. Doug McDonald, former Washington State Transportation Secretary. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Be safe.
Right.
Walk on out of here with caution.
Well, you got to have caution because a bike comes by you and may or may not say something to you as they pass by.
Doug, thank you.
Yeah.
That's the record today produced by Amina Al-Sadi, Allison Bruzek, Ajua Jim Abrempong, Jason Pagano, social media producer Bree Ripley. Join us tomorrow for the Week in Review.